Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, how many times a day do you check the weather or the weather forecast? Our guest today argues you have one man to thank for the modern day science that we use to forecast the weather. Our guest, a familiar voice to many of you, John Martin. He's a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, also an author. And his new book is called Reginald Sutcliffe and the Invention of Modern Weather Systems Science, published by Purdue University Press. So as we visit with John, what questions do you have about the history of weather forecasting? What weather tracking inventions do you want to know more about? Why do you think it's important in today's world to understand the weather? Join in the conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And John Martin, welcome back. Good to have you with us. As an author this time.
Well, it's a real pleasure. You're giving me a wonderful opportunity here. It's always great to talk to you, but especially under these circumstances. Thank you very much.
Well, I tell you what, before we begin talking about the book, give us a little of your background. I know a lot of people have heard you many, many times on the show, but tell us about your background.
Well, I grew up in northeastern Massachusetts, where it snows like crazy in the wintertime. And I had the great fortune of beginning my morning paper route on the day that President Truman died in 1972. So I did that for 8 years, and it was about the snowiest decade on record in southern New England. So it couldn't have been more perfectly suited for me. So that crystallized my interest in the weather at a young age, and I never have lost it. And so to have the opportunity to study it formally as an undergraduate and then as a graduate student and then to come to the remarkable University of Wisconsin to work for nearly 30 years as a scholar and research scientist has been a great turn in my life. And along the way, I discovered that an individual who lived long before I did had his fingerprints all over much of the stuff that I ended up falling in love with. So I felt an obligation to learn a little bit more about his life.
So that's how the book came to be. And actually taught many of the things that, you know, sort of he discovered.
Yeah. You know, when my first assignment, when I got my job here at Wisconsin in the spring of 94 is when I found out I was going to be starting here in the fall of 94. My first assignment was to teach a class on mid-latitude weather systems. And so that was my developing expertise as a graduate student. And I had to sit down and put down my notes for this class, because as you know, when you first have a teaching assignment, you don't have anything. You've got to figure out how you're going to fill 45 hours of lecture in a short order. And as I was doing that, I realized, wow, Sutcliffe had his fingerprints on everything. We didn't know in the 1920s or before the 1930s, actually, how weather systems actually develop and propagate across the landscape. We didn't know how mid-latitude weather systems with their fronts actually generate the cloud and precipitation along the fronts. We knew that they did. We didn't know how. And it turns out that Reggie Sutcliffe figured all of that out in relative isolation in the late 1930s. And then World War II intervened. His career was sidelined, as happened for so many people in a variety of professions. And then that generation decided, even after with that horrific interruption, they would come back and rebuild a safer world. And they did it. And he was part of it. And he built the scientific infrastructure that we all enjoy.
Well, he's a really, really fascinating guy. Just thinking back, aviation really raised, you talk about this in the book, aviation really raised the profile of weather forecasting, didn't it?
It really did, Larry. I mean, suddenly we had this tool that could loft us into the air, and we had no knowledge about what the air really meant and how it could change and what was up there. And so suddenly we had this urgency of trying to figure out, wait a minute, we need to know what clouds are made of. We need to know how they develop. We need to know something about weather systems and how I can make a route forecast from San Francisco to Seattle. And all manner of urgent problems arose as soon as this great new invention was there. And so, yeah, meteorology's profile was raised immediately by aviation. No question about it.
And Sutcliffe, I mean, he was born, what, 1904 or something like
1904,
that?
1904, right. That's right.
So he sort of almost at the ground the ground floor of
he
of
really all, was he well, was on the ground floor about,
well tell us about his early times early days
his early years are quite unusual for you know what I think most of us in the field and many of our friends in the field recognize is a lifelong passion about weather. He didn't have that. He was just a very smart student. He came from a lower middle class background. His father and mother, in fact, had been child laborers in factories. And that was a tragedy in England from the late 18th century all into the early 20th century, really, and probably beyond. And so his generation, he and his brothers were the first to not have to labor in factories in the Sutcliffe family history. And they were very good in school. And he went to some really inspiring places to go to school in Cleckheaton in Yorkshire and in the West Riding of England. And had met some very influential people who kind of kept prodding him on to bigger and better things. And he went to the University of Leeds after finishing his secondary school. And when he was done with the math degree at Leeds in 1925, the school said, we'd love to have you stay on and do your PhD. But of course, there's no such thing as any scientific infrastructure in any of the Western countries at that time that would support graduate research. So he had to go back to his old secondary school and plead for a scholarship that he had not used for his undergraduate days. And they gave it to him. And then he went off and got his PhD in mathematics. There were no jobs for mathematicians in England 10 years after the war. And so he, as a last ditch, went to the meteorological office. And thank God he did, because now we can look at our phones and see what the weather's going to be.
That's for sure. Well, you the the war, the part of your book has to do with World War II and what went on weather-wise in World War II. Can you give us some of the background and his role in that?
Yeah, so aviation was seen as a big, especially in England. The English had this view that they were going to win the war from the air, and the Germans certainly did, but they built up their Luftwaffe. And so aviation had a primary place in preparations for and then immediate execution of the war. And so the meteorological staff in a lot of countries, Germany included, and in the Allied countries had been built up from 1918 to about 1939 in a way that was quite revolutionary, as we were just discussing. But Sutcliffe's role was he was the senior meteorological officer for part of his role in the war. He had a multi-dimensional war record, as it turns out, but 3.5 years he spent as the senior meteorological officer at number 3 bomber group from Bomber Command in England. And their jobs were really concentrated on the northern German industrial centers of Hamburg and some of the other big cities, Cologne. So Sutcliffe was sending Air Force sorties out to northern England and parts of the occupied countries for 3.5 years and trying to make forecasts of the flight level winds, not only at the time of departure, but the time of return. So, and these were usually 6 to 8 hour sorties. And so that's a long forecast at a time when there was no substantial guidance at all about how to make forecasts. And so one of his big innovations during the war was changing the way we look at the vertical structure of the atmosphere on a routine basis. Others had come up with the idea of using pressure as the vertical measure of up and down and not height, which is the way we actually see things. And Sutcliffe really implemented that, really worked hard to make that work. And it turns out he had some great innovations about flight level forecasting that got the attention of the higher ups in the Admiralty. And he won several awards. He was mentioned in despatches during the war 3 times, and he was made an Order of the British Empire by King George VI during the war for his advances in flight level wind forecasting. This was all way before there was any computer. So it was just pure intellect and pure will.
So how did he do it?
It turns out that the atmosphere is structured in such a way that the average temperature in a layer of air that can extend either from the ground to 10 feet above the ground or from the ground to 10 miles above the ground, the depth of that layer depends on the column average temperature. That's all you need to know is the temperature of the air to know how thick that layer is. And it turns out that if you assume a few things about how you make a guess about the temperature of that air column, we don't make guesses now, but in the war, there weren't very many what we call radiosondes, which are balloon instrument packages that go up through the atmosphere and actually measure these things for you. So we have these as measurements today. It wasn't so common in the war. So you'd take flight level data from pilots who were taking notes if you asked them to, and you'd get some information about the vertical temperature structure that would allow you to figure out how deep the atmosphere was from the ground to flight level. And then if you knew what the surface pressure was, because of some mathematical innovations that Sutcliffe was kind of working with, he was able to take surface pressure observations, which were plentiful, and take this vertical temperature structure information, which was more or less an educated guess, and use the two to construct upper level wind shots that were really accurate in the short term, 6 to 8 hours. And it was a revolution.
Oh, man. I tell you what, it's an amazing story. John Martin, our guest, he is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and his book, fascinating book, Reginald Sutcliffe and the Invention of Modern Weather Systems Science. It's fun talking with him, and you can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. What do you want to know about the history of weather forecasting? What weather inventions maybe you want to know more about? Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Ron in Greendale, we'll give you a chance. Ron, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, good morning. I was wondering if your learned guest might have a little insight into the earlier weather perusals of Mr. Increase Lapham and how he did things that may have aided this later gentleman in all his efforts.
Yeah, that's a good question, Ron. Increase Lapham was a famous meteorologist here in the state of Wisconsin. I think he issued the first storm warning ever by the United States Signal Service, which then became the Weather Service many years later. And that was for the Great Lakes. I think it was for Lake Michigan out of the Milwaukee office. And it must have been 1870 or 71 because the Signal Service started in 1870. So Lapham was an observational meteorologist. I don't think he made many contributions to theoretical meteorology. And but he did set a stage that led, of course, with careful observations, it sets the stage for the building of what are called conceptual models. That is, models that make you understand how a variety of different observations come together to tell you something about the current state of the weather and how it's related to the structure of maybe a weather system within which your weather is embedded. And that was about as far as the science had gone through the 1920s. The Norwegians had made contributions to furthering such conceptual models for mid-latitude cyclones. And Sutcliffe became quite discouraged in his early career in the meteorological office with the fact that none of those models really had any physical rigor and any physical substance mathematical integrity. And that was one of the things that motivated him to work as hard as he did at being creative in the urgency of World War II to come up with some new ways of thinking about how to attack the problem of weather systems, structure, science, and then forecasting. So Lapham had some foundational contributions to a stage that maybe came a generation before Sutcliffe, and he was a very famous person. I don't know if there's a biography of Lapham. I think there might be a short one somewhere. There should be a longer one because he was kind of a pivotal figure, and that's about as much as I know about him.
Oh, Ron, thank you so much for calling. John Martin, our guest, the book Reginald Sutcliffe and the Invention of Modern Weather System Science. Jane Rotunda, our producer today. Natalie Guyette is our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a pretty interesting guy. His name is Reginald Sutcliffe, and that's the first part of the title of the book that John Martin wrote, Reginald Sutcliffe and the Invention of Modern Weather System Science. Join in with your questions and comments. Love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You know, I'll just go back to the war for a minute. There was some famous, you do write about the D-Day invasion.
The
forecast. Talk a little about that.
What an amazing run-up. I learned a lot by having to do the research for Sutcliffe's role in the discussions and the build-up for the invasion. But there's a great book by James Stagg, who was the Allied leader, actually, of the forecasting teams. There were United States and British teams. And the British team included a few people from other countries, like Svea Pedersen from Norway and some others. The American team was mostly a Caltech group. And Stagg's impossible job was to try and reconcile utterly disparate views about how to make forecasts, and then also about trying to agree with them, and then tell them to Eisenhower and Montgomery and other of the bigwigs. And they began this exercise in the build-up to the invasion in late February, early February 1944. They started to make experimental 5- and 10-day forecasts, which were almost entirely erroneous every time. And with the anticipation of, they knew they had to make a long-term forecast in an era when even a one-day forecast was more or less a guess. And the reason they had to make a five-day forecast, of course, was the Allies had to keep this huge maritime naval invasion fleet had to be kept hidden. And so many of the ships were in, you know, northern Scotland waiting for the go-ahead to start their way down to the coast of France. And that was a four-day ferry. So they had to have a medium-range forecast, what we would today call a medium-range forecast for the weather. And it turns out the month of June 1944 was about the worst June of the 20th century in terms of repeated intense storms that would come up towards the Channel area and just off the coast of France. And as the day drew close, they were supposed to go on the 5th of June. That was the original day for Overlord. And Stagg and the colleagues, Sutcliffe made some contributions, but he was in an unfortunately secondary role at the time, even though he had had great success as a forecaster in the other part of the war. They had put him at fighter command at Bentley Priory, and he had no particular role to play in the invasion forecasting, but he was on phone conversations, and Stagg credits him on June 3rd, 4th, and 5th with some really important comments about what he suspected was going to be the cause for delay on the 5th and opportunity for operations on the 6th. So it must have been an unbelievably harrowing time and nearly impossible time for the forecasters, because they just didn't have a science that was ripe enough to do the job that they were called upon to do.
You were talking about, I think you were discussing what is called the development theorem.
Yeah, the development theorem.
And you argue that was Sutcliffe's greatest contribution.
Yeah,
more about that.
I think my colleagues would probably agree with that, so that's not really walking the plank at all. Development in meteorological context refers to the tendency for cyclones to either intensify, get more intense, or to weaken. And of course, that's going to impact the local weather in terms of if the cyclone's getting more and more intense, the winds are usually increasing, the cloud shield is enlarging, precipitation's becoming more widespread. The circulation may be in training colder air from northern latitudes in our hemisphere that will make some of that precipitation turn to snow and so on. So the intensification of a cyclone is a really important physical question in meteorology. And so is the decay. So is the disappearance of them. Where do they go? And until the 1930s and until really Sutcliffe's efforts in the 1930s, nobody had a really good handle on how to describe this important process by which these storms go through their life cycle. And at the time, also, there was a scarcity of observations that were necessary to help to build theory. Sometimes theory is built upon what you know you can observe, and then the observations spur you to new questions and so on. So it's interactive. It isn't always just one sits down with a piece of paper and pencil and comes up with a new theory. It's born of observational capability in some ways. It's certainly true in the satellite meteorology world. And so Sutcliffe was able to construct a theory that was not only accurate and solid scientifically, but also amenable to using the tools of observation that were available at the time. And so it was an instant, gigantic advance on trying to make a reasonable prediction about what will be the fate 2 days later of this weather system, given its environment that we can measure in a certain way. Can we then say what this storm is likely to do in terms of its intensity, its track, where will it go, and what kind of weather it might produce for various locations in the region that it's approaching? And this was a huge revolution. It immediately made a 1 or 2 day forecast leap from the territory of an educated guess to something that was really a solid assertion. And it's hard to overestimate that, overstate it, I should say. And then immediately after the war, the computer had been used for decoding, as everyone knows, at Bletchley Park. So the British had some of the best computer scientists in the world at their disposal. They also had these new tools about observing and theorizing about how weather systems work, and they put them both together in the early 1950s and started their own march toward numerical weather prediction, which we all enjoy today. A companion effort was started in the United States and in Sweden, but it wasn't asking exactly the same question as the one in England. And so it had a little bit more early success than the English success came later, but was more substantial. It's kind of an interesting dichotomy there.
And Sutcliffe wasn't necessarily enamored with computers, at least to begin with.
No, he was highly skeptical of the advances that were likely to come out of the numerical weather prediction enterprise. It turns out he was wrong. They were definitely world-changing. But I think it was a function of he had spent so many years, and his colleagues who he had for whom he had great esteem, had spent so many years learning and creating the theory underlying these weather systems and had been operational forecasters before they had invented the theory, that they realized they had an odd and now never to be replaced concoction of great intellectual rigor as well as a sense of how the weather works that goes maybe a little bit beyond the intellectual side of things. And I think he was sad to see that compromised, and especially since so much attention was invested in the computer side with so little return for the first 10 to 15, actually 20 years of effort, that it probably just tired him out psychically. And he was never really a big proponent of numerical weather prediction as a consequence.
Yeah. And he was with the Weather Service. Well, he started, as you were saying, I guess he started just because he needed a job, practically.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He started on Friday, September 30th, 1927. It happens to be the day Babe Ruth hit his 60th home run in that season. But but he retired. He resigned from the meteorological office in 1965 to take up the professorship at the University of Reading, where he established the first undergraduate meteorology program in the United Kingdom. So that was a post-retirement job for him that he started in 1965. So he had a 38-year career at the meteorological office.
You know, he was made. There were some interesting. You've got some interesting facts and figures and so forth in there. What kind of a guy was he? What did his peers think of him? You know, what was his personality like? You know, a mathematician. You kind of have this view of a guy maybe that not very outgoing and all that, but Sutcliffe wasn't like that, was he?
No, it seems that he was not like that. I met his daughters, and they would definitely testify to the fact that he was outgoing, he was ebullient, he was one of those people who you'd want to be talking to at a party. He was thinking about his young life. He was a big man on campus. He was the head boy, which is the top male prefect at his school. He was the president of a mathematical society at Leeds. He gave after-dinner speeches in college, and he became famous for that in his long career. In fact, there's a famous story about his wit that was well-developed from all the practice, that he had entertained some colleagues in Geneva at a World Meteorological Organization meeting. On his own dime, he brought him out for drinks, and then he tried to get reimbursed as a person might from the government when he came back to England. And the people at Whitehall said, no, sorry, we don't reimburse for alcohol. And he wrote back to somebody, some high official at Whitehall. He said, my mother always told me courtesy costs nothing. I now understand that that's also the policy of Her Majesty's government. So that gives you an idea that, you know, he had this kind of really wry, incisive sense of humor. But another story that his daughter Ellen told me was that she went to get her driver's license whenever the schedule is for that for English, teens or early 20s, and she failed her test, and she came home very sad about that. And her dad, she said, told her, "Don't worry about it, honey. We'll just go out and work on it again tomorrow." And he never made her feel bad about it. He just said, "That's just how things go sometimes. Let's go out and practice again tomorrow. You'll get it the next time." So he was somebody who was a good coach, somebody who could encourage in the face of despair. So it strikes me, and in his necrology written by one of his colleagues, John Sawyer, they said, aside from all of his great contributions to our science, most people will remember him who interacted with him as just a downright excellent person to be around. So, yeah, one gets the sense he was just a really great person.
And, you know, quote, I would love to have heard him speak.
Yeah,
because he did. He was, as you say, he was apparently a great speaker. I noted in one of the speech, I think when he was made a fellow of the Royal Society, he noted, I think then he was talking about, weather control, whether or not we could control the weather, that sort of thing. And he had, you quote something that I thought, oh my goodness, I didn't know that he said a thunderstorm has an average, on average converts as much energy as a nuclear bomb. And there are about 10 million thunderstorms.
Yeah. Yeah. Here. As hot as it is to imagine at the inception of the idea of numerical weather prediction, in fact, the first meeting ever held on it, January 1946, they were talking about controlling the weather as the primary option, a primary objective. The secondary one was, well, in order to control it, we'll have to kind of know what's supposed to happen. So we'll have to be able to forecast it, too, I suppose. And that didn't go away for a long time. He gave a lecture in 1965 at his old grammar school that was called Predicting and Controlling the Weather. So even as late as 1965, this had to enter the discussion when one talked about prediction, which is incredible. And his point about thunderstorms is people were saying we can just explode a few bombs here and there to change the course of weather systems. And he correctly pointed out, if that were true, then individual thunderstorms, of which there are millions at any one moment on Earth, would be doing that already. So you should go back to the drawing board on that idea. So, yeah. And he wasn't, that was another aspect of his personality, Larry. He was not afraid to confront fools with their crazy schemes and criticize them for it. And then he'd still be friends with them, but he wouldn't hesitate to criticize people.
oh my goodness. Well, his time at the, he was certainly honored, as you said, for his years at the weather in weather forecasting. And then his talk a bit more about his work, after when he became a professor.
Yeah, it was an interesting time after he had really kind of stepped away from the forecasting and really stepped away a little bit from research in the early 1960s before he resigned from the meteorological office. He took on major international roles with the World Meteorological Organization, which is still, of course, a going concern, and it's an outgrowth of the United Nations. It's a United Nations-sponsored organization. And one of Sutcliffe's main emphases while he served for many years in the World Meteorological Organization was education and training of meteorologists in third world countries, because it occurred to him that not every country has the resources to build its own internal weather service and to have its own, you know, Apollo program and all the rest of these kinds of giant science things from the second half of the 20th century. But he said it's really incumbent upon the Western countries and any country that's wealthy enough to do it, to support the development of local experts in weather forecasting and weather science, because it's so important to every country's economy. And so he spent a lot of time in the World Meteorological Organization doing exactly that. And this interest in education and training spurred him to think about starting an undergraduate program in the United Kingdom, and the first one that was ever done was at the University of Reading under his tutelage beginning in 1965. Mm-hmm. And he spent 5 years there as the chair. And the University of Reading now is one of the top programs in the world. I'd say anybody would say that who knows our field would say Reading is in the top three or four easily, maybe always the top in terms of its reputation. So it was a successful endeavor that he launched in 1965.
And that, you know, this World Weather Watch, I was fascinated by that. And it kind of goes along with what you were just talking about. He said it would cost maybe $100 million, mm-hmm. which he said sounds like a lot of money, but that's only 4 cents a person.
Yeah, per year. Right. So, and if you know about the global circulation, that was one of his big things. And once he got past, you know, his contributions to individual weather systems, he was really interested in the global circulation of the atmosphere. And so observing it comprehensively, as was proposed in the World Weather Program, at that huge cost, yeah, you know, if you talk to the wrong person, someone's going to say $100 million is just wastful spending. If you talk to Sutcliffe, he'd say, no, that's an investment in security, food security, water security, and all sorts of other things, as well as raising people to a higher standard of living because they'll be educated about the weather. So there's many, many positives from spending this money. And I think we still suffer from this in our society, the choice some people make to call spending money just spending, whereas others call it an investment. And I think in many instances, investment's the way to look at it.
Vern called and brought up HARP, or High Frequency Active Oral Research Program, designed to the properties and behavior of the atmosphere. Did Sutcliffe have anything with that, or do you know anything about HARP?
I've only heard the acronym. I'm not sure I do know anything about it. I'm pretty sure that it's more of a modern development. I don't think Sutcliffe had anything to do with it. Well, I should say, I know he didn't. Yeah.
And Sutcliffe died almost 20 years to the day. I think he died in 1991, didn't he?
Yeah, and, so it's coming up on 30 years. Yeah, it's coming up on 30 years. At the
30
end of the
years, well, yeah,
the
what am I
month.
Saying?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a long time ago, and it's kind of sad for me because I was studying the science at the time that he died, and I wish that I had known about him when he was alive, you know, somehow. I didn't, and so that's unfortunate. I would love to have met him, but I never did.
Well, you did wind up having a good relationship with his daughters.
Oh, life changed.
And the families.
Yep. And found them by accident. They weren't people who had a public profile. They weren't easy to find. I found them by hook or by crook, quite literally. A librarian I'd met at the University of Reading, who was instantly interested in the project, had a genealogy service that she and her family subscribed to. And she had come across a name at the end of one. She had been, you know, she was said, I'll do whatever I can to help you find these things. And she had come across a name at the end of the Oxford biography, a dictionary of biographies, in which Sutcliffe has an entry. And she said, this is an interesting last name. Somebody named Ellen Bowes had contributed to that. And so she found some connections through her genealogy service to an Ellen Bowes, who turns out, I don't have time to tell you the whole story, but it's in the book, especially at the end in the acknowledgments. She found the family, and I made connections with them, and I visited them several times over the last several years. And Sutcliffe had two daughters, Ellen and Jenny, and Jenny lives in Brittany. She's moved recently. She's still in France, but not in Brittany anymore. And Ellen lives in Norfolk in England. And so I've had the profound pleasure of becoming friends with these wonderful people. And they invited me in. They did their homework for me. They had all manner of materials from their dad's life and their mother's life that they could share with me. And I was able to turn the book into something more of a story about a human being and his interaction with the world than just his science. And I couldn't have done that without that help. I couldn't have done it.
Yeah, you've written many other things. What's unique about writing a biography? And certainly you talked about a challenge here.
Yeah, it's nothing like any of the other writing that I've done in my career, but it was fun in the sense, but a challenge. And I never had any idea how it came out. I think it came out okay. But the challenge was, how do you make it a story that people are going to care about? And when you're sprinkling in individual, you know, story about this person's life, but also about their contributions they've made to their professional life and the world, because the professional contributions are the ones that impact the world. It's not the personal ones that matter so much in this particular life. And so it was fun trying to balance that. And so I didn't have the notion every morning that I was going to do this job or that job. I just did a job. I just kept moving forward in the narrative. And then when it came time to take the red pen to this giant pile of papers, that's when one had to start shaping it into a story. And I kept trying to imagine, how would I, as a reader, want to hear this story? You know, and are there times where it's a little bit too thick? Are there times where it's a little too thin? And so you try and, you know, make the amendments you need to make to keep it as interesting as possible all the way through. So I hope that's what happened. But that was the challenge.
And your audience for the book?
Meant to be a broad audience, interested. You can't be uninterested in the weather. I don't think you can anyway, Larry, as you know, I've told you that for years. But I mean, if you're really thoroughly uninterested in the weather, maybe you don't care about this book. But I think everybody is. Everybody I meet at the bus stop is. And So it's written for a very broad interested audience. There will be times, I think, for people who don't know the meteorological vernacular, which I introduce in the book, so you don't have to know it ahead of time. You don't have to follow all those arguments in detail if you don't want, because the story always keeps coming back to this person and this person's interaction with other people. And so I think there's enough in there for just about anybody to find it interesting, because there's a lot of World War II in there. There's a lot of post-World War II in there, and there's a lot of early 20th century history from England in there. So there's something for everybody.
Which I found really interesting. Well, in the end, where should this guy be placed?
Hall of Fame. He's a Hall of Fame type scientist. I think if he were still alive, I had this dream that you could petition for knighthood. He almost got it when he was alive, and of course you can't get it when you're dead. But he was really at that level. The Queen in 1976 had a story about, I forget what it was called. It was like her 25th or 20th year in her reign. So she had a what's happened in the 20 years. I forget what it's called, but what's happened in the 20 years I've been queen. And one of the top 12 things that she listed was the introduction of numerical weather forecasting at the meteorological office. She didn't call it that, but the improvements in weather forecasting. And I think that Sutcliffe was not recognized as having contributed to that advance. And I think that he would have liked to have been recognized for that, even though he wasn't really, in favor of the development of numerical weather prediction as it came out. He nonetheless contributed to it. And I think that puts him in the Hall of Fame. He's one of the gods in the meteorological firmament.
Well, he's an interesting guy, that's for sure. And you've told us an interesting story, John.
Thank you very much, Larry. I appreciate that.
And you're going to hang around because your fellow weather guy, Steve Ackerman's coming in, and he'll be with us.
That's
shortly.
Correct.
We'll talk weather and climate. In the meantime, just to remind you, John Martin, our guest, and his book is Reginald Sutcliffe and the Invention of Modern Weather Systems Science. We talked about a little bit, but about the book. But there's a whole lot more that we didn't get to, and you'd have a chance to look at when you read it. And you'll have a chance to talk to him some more if you got a question along those lines as we visit with our weather guys, John and Steve. You can bring those in as well. But for now, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.